wanted to get a sense from you first of when your interest in mathematics started. Was that early on, or did that develop later?
Well, it was kind of curious because I was always good in mathematics. It was no problem. Mm-hmm. I went on to college as an undergraduate, and my parents were pushing me. My father was a dentist. They wanted me to be a dentist or a doctor. I was going to be in the medical profession. No question about that. So I went to my undergraduate school, Holy Cross, and I said, okay, be a pre-med major, no problem. You've got to major in something, and we recommend that you not major in biology. Uh-huh. Now, I don't know whether they're just saying that because there was no room in the biology major, or they were saying, they said to me, it'd look better to medical schools when you apply if you had, you know, a different talent. Okay, so I'll major in math. That's easy for me, you know, a lot easier than biology or whatever. So I started taking math courses, and okay, calculus was fine, no problem. Then I got into a topology course, and the instructor was showing me these incredibly complicated pictures that were just beautiful. You know, we didn't have the computer then. You couldn't see fractals, but these were almost fractals. But every time he'd show something in class and say, this is an aberration, you know, this is a counterexample to a theorem. You'll never see something like this again. But I said, oh my God, this is absolutely amazing. So, boom, I get out of medicine. I was going on in mathematics, absolutely, to be a topologist. And in fact, well, let me continue the story, because it gets a little sad. I went on to graduate school and said, now I'm going to start taking topology. And the first topology course I took was, of course, algebraic topology. Mm-hmm. Back then, topology had become very algebraic. Right. So I was in this graduate course for a full year, and the instructor never drew a single picture. Mm-hmm. Not quite. He did draw the unit circle once. I said, wait a minute, what have I done to myself? Well, luckily, dynamical systems was blooming then, and there all the pictures reappeared, and so there I was, back doing exactly what I wanted to do. So it was really that course as an undergraduate that switched my direction.
Uh-huh. You went to UC Berkeley for...
graduate school.
For graduate school. Right, right. Was there a particular reason why you chose UC Berkeley?
Well, I loved California. I wanted to get out of the snow. There were a lot of good topologists at Berkeley in those days, so that seemed like an ideal place for me to go.
So how did you connect up with Stephen Smale?
Well, as I gravitated from topology toward dynamical systems, back then celestial mechanics was very big. A lot of people were involved in it. Moser, Kolmogorov, Arnold, and Stephen Smale was doing celestial mechanics. He was working for a year or two in celestial mechanics. So I had, you know, seen some of his lectures on more general dynamical systems, but one on the n-body problem, and, you know, the topology of the n-body problem. I said, oh, wait a minute, this connects up really nicely. So I went to work with him in more celestial mechanics, but it was dynamical systems. You know, back then it was very high dimensional, so you wouldn't see as many pictures. Over the years, I've gone down to the complex plane, where now I'm seeing all those same pictures that I saw as an undergraduate, only they're not aberrations anymore. They're, you know, the main things I see all the time. So sort of come full circle in that sense.
So what was your thesis on?
Was actually on reversible systems. They're a kind of differential equation. There are many what they call Hamiltonian systems, the things that come up in mechanics, classical mechanics, are reversible, time reversible, but there's sort of other ways of being reversible. And so I sort of studied different ideas of reversible systems.
Were you at that time already as a graduate student getting into visualization and some of the technology involved in doing
that? No, the computer still had not been really present. I mean, there were people, you know, using a lot of punch cards and running down to the basement and coming back a day later with a bunch of X's all over the place. So visualization wasn't quite there that in the early 70s, but it did change within the next decade for sure.
So when after being a graduate student, what were you looking for in a position?
Well, I wanted a more research-oriented position, but I enjoyed teaching, so I wanted something that, you know, had a good student body and good possibilities for a teaching career as well. So I wanted a research. I wanted graduate students around, and I wanted to have good undergraduates around, and I wanted to, you know, intermingle with both. So
you end up initially at what university?
So my postdoc was at Northwestern,
where
they have a large group in dynamical systems, which was very fruitful for me.
Was Donald Sari there?
Donald Sari was there, and he's now working more on voting stuff, but back then he was working on celestial mechanics, and that was one of the main reasons I came. But there were many other people like Clark Robinson, and Bob Williams, John Franks. Bob Williams, really a topologist, he was bringing that aspect into it. John Franks worked with my advisor, Stephen Smale, and Clark Robinson worked in mechanics as well, so it was a perfect opportunity for me to get started in different areas.
Right, and then from Northwestern to?
Then I went to Tufts University back in Boston, where I'm from, for 4 years. And then I moved to Boston University. I got offered a tenured position there. Well, no, I got offered a tenure track position there. I had tenure at Tufts. The Boston University environment was a little different. They really wanted to build their math department, and they sort of brought me in to do that. So that was a kind of interesting, stepping stone for me in that sense.
I meant to ask earlier on, you were up in Boston then?
Yes,
Somehow I had a sense that you had.
Well, I packed my car in Harvard Yard, and I guess it might be a there, not here. But most people know him. I try to hide my New England accent, but it doesn't always come out.
But you ended up back in Boston.
Yeah. Well, I grew up north of Boston, close to New Hampshire. And in fact, that's where we raised our kids, and more or less the same town, the same town where I grew up. But now, since the kids fall left, I'm back right in the middle of Boston. So right on Boston Harbor. So love it.
Now, when did the visualization work start? That'd be you.
I first started doing some programming at Tufts in the late 70s. BASIC was around then, so you could start seeing things but nothing, I was still working in a little higher dimensions, so it wasn't really that fruitful to me. But then the year I moved to Boston University in 1980 is when the Mandelbrot set came out. And right about then I was back in one-dimensional dynamics looking at X squared plus C. There across the river is Benoit Mandelbrot. And I remember going to his lecture, which proves how stupid I am. And he showed all these pictures, and he's dealing with z squared plus c. And I said, why would anybody iterate a complex analytic function? If you make a change here, it changes everything everywhere, So, of course, here that's all I've been doing for the last for many years. Right. But, so that, when you started seeing pictures like the Mandelbrot sets and the Julia sets and and things like that, then all of a sudden you say, wait a minute, there's much more going on here. And we still don't understand z squared plus c. It's amazing. Even though it's so beautiful, the fact is we don't understand it.
Okay. Now, initially there was some criticism or controversy over whether this kind of stuff counted as real mathematics. That there was a sense that the kind of thing that Benoit Mandelbrot was doing was sort of hand-wavy and showy, but not real, sort of solid mathematics.
Back then, he suffered a lot of, I think, unfortunate criticism because he was more visionary than prover. He didn't prove anything. He made conjectures, but he was the one that brought the Mandelbrot set to the forefront. And, then all of a sudden, within 5 years, you've got Jack Milner, mm-hmm. you've got Bill Thurston, you've got Adrien Douady, you've got all these Fields medalists, all these great mathematicians, Kurt McMullen, Bonafide, mm-hmm. you know, Christophe Lepose, at least four mm-hmm. Fields medalists who've worked in this area, mm-hmm. you know, who were filling in the blanks
right.
that Mandelbrot sort of uncovered. Mm-hmm. So it is unfortunate that he never proved mm-hmm. a lot of these things, but he mm-hmm. was really the person who mm-hmm. instigated all of this research, mm-hmm. and there's a reason why it's called Mandelbrot set.
Yes.
he
right.
popularized it.
Right.
Not only just fractals in general.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's another very interesting area of mathematics that was always around, but
right.
no one ever knew, you know, that mm-hmm. they were fractals.
Right. So in what directions did your research develop then?
Well, as I came down in dimension, you know, right around when I started seeing Mandelbrot, I had gone down to one-dimensional iterated mm-hmm. functions, you know, and then all of a sudden realized mm-hmm. that, wait a minute, in a complex plane, you have many more tools. You mm-hmm. A, have visualization, B, you have complex analysis, mm-hmm. and then using these two tools, you can then understand iterating real functions. For example, right back then, science advisor, the Queen, a biologist was saying to mathematicians, "Why are you working in high dimensions? We in biology, our simplest model is the logistic population mm-hmm. growth model, a quadratic function. We can't understand that. Please help us." Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that's sort of brought me down.
Mm-hmm.
Robert May, that's his
right.
son, yeah. It sort of brought me into going mm-hmm. to lower dimensions.
Now, as that developed, it seemed that you also got interested in educational side, because you ended up developing materials for teaching this kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I was always interested in education, or, you know, I used to love to teach the chaos course to my mm-hmm. students. You know, it would be a student right after, you just need freshman calculus to understand it, yet I could introduce topics that were contemporary research. Then one of our math ed people in our School of Education came to me and said, you know, I'm getting this big grant to mm-hmm. show high school teachers how to A, incorporate technology into the classroom. This was the mid to late 80s. And also sort of bring some new ideas into the classroom. And would you be willing to help out? Well, I've never been in high school since, you know, back when I was a high school student, so I don't know whether I can help out. But yeah, I'd like to, you know, start to do something. Well, he got his $1 million grant, whatever it was back then, and immediately took a job at another university. Mm-hmm. And I was the only faculty member that was on this. So I became the PI. I had no idea what a high school teacher was. So we started running these programs, summer mm-hmm. programs, to show mm-hmm. teachers how to incorporate technology into the classroom and how mm-hmm. to bring some different ideas. And what happened was the teachers, we were a little bit worried about using the computer, but mm-hmm. the ideas of bringing something like chaos or fractals mm-hmm. into the classroom, they didn't think that would work. So he said, well, okay, let's run a chaos club. So we were in some chaos clubs in inner city schools in Boston, where we put our little Macs, and the students would come after class mm-hmm. and they'd run little programs and see things and do the math, and they absolutely loved it, you know. So the teachers would come in and say, wait a minute, these kids, they're asleep in my class all the time. They're staying after school to do math. Mm-hmm. I remember one time the janitor came in, had a bunch of kids working on the computers, and the janitor says, you got to go home. We got to get out of here. We got to clean this room. The kid said, no, I'm doing math. I'm staying here. So it's a real eye-opener for me and for the teachers. And that program eventually expanded to include a whole bunch of mm-hmm. school districts. So I was going to different school districts every week to work with teachers, and it really became a passion for me, but it was just too much. So that's when we started what we call our math field days, mm-hmm. where every year We have at least 2 field days where we bring each time 500 or 600 kids mm-hmm. from various high schools from all over New England mm-hmm. into our university for a day of mathematical activities, no contests or anything, just some lectures. Ideally, they're on current topics in mathematics, but mm-hmm. that are accessible to the students. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we bring our graduate students in, and they do hands-on projects mm-hmm. with groups of them. But that's been going on for 20 years now, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's really been successful. Mm-hmm. Kids, you know, it's a nice opportunity for the high school teachers, because if you think about it, many teachers in high school have opportunities to take mm-hmm. their kids on field days to science, go to the science museum, the mm-hmm. humanities, can go to the art mm-hmm. museum or whatever, but where can mathematicians go? Well, they've been coming to the field day for many of them, have been coming for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And
is that done at BU?
That's at BU, yeah. And we do a couple of remote locations mm-hmm. each year, California mm-hmm. often. And, but it's usually in the fall at mm-hmm. BU if I'm there in the fall. Mm-hmm. But it's something that really works well, and there are some great mathematicians out there. We bring in different people mm-hmm. each year to give talks, and there are some people who can really communicate well with high school mm-hmm. kids and teachers. And many of our kids come from the inner city schools in Boston, and they're right up front, you know, mm-hmm. paying attention. Wow, mm-hmm. this is great. So it's really, the teachers think it makes a difference for their mm-hmm. students, and it's clear to see, mm-hmm. you know, students who are wide awake, you know, participating, really interested. It's good.
I would think the visualization part of it also helps.
Absolutely. Well, the lecture I will be giving tonight is actually one of the lectures I give at these math field days. You see it's visualization. Mm-hmm. You see there's a lot of mathematics in the background, but it's a lecture that I give just to let them say, wait a minute, I'm going to have to know linear algebra, probability, mm-hmm. you know, all of these other topics. I don't go into detail, obviously, with the high school students, but mm-hmm. they get to see that not only are these pictures interesting, but it involves every area of mm-hmm. mathematics. Mm-hmm. So,
how did your involvement with the MAA start?
Well, I've been an MAA member since I think I was 3 years old, if I remember. I've been since a graduate student, so I've just been involved with the MAA. I've done a lot of, I don't know how many workshops, summer workshops, at math fest, the joint math meetings over mm-hmm. the years. I've been probably more involved with the AMS and the NCTM than uh-huh. with MAA. I mean, not anymore, obviously, but when I had all this work with high mm-hmm. school teachers, yep. I was going to, I think I'd been to, I don't know, 70 or 80 NCTM meetings over uh-huh. the years to give talks. Uh-huh. And the AMS is right in Providence. I've been on a lot of committees there. I've actually been involved with all the 3 organizations. Right. My idea is MAA is right in the middle. Mm-hmm. MAA is the magnet that can draw from both sides and bring the mathematics community together. AMS mm-hmm. can't reach down right. all the way to NCTM, and NCTM doesn't want to reach up to right. AMS. Yeah. But,
You've also been involved a bit with publications at the MAA, too.
I've been on numerous committees. I don't know how many publication committees.
Right.
Is
that a particular interest, or?
Well, I've written a number of books, so publication has always been something that's, of interest to me. So I just do it because it's there, and it's something. Right. I like to push my colleagues to write books, but mm-hmm. I never succeed for some reason.
Uh-huh. But hard work.
It is. It's impossible to get people to write books unless they know they want to write it, then right. they're going to write it. And yeah. they just have to trip on them at the time and mm-hmm. say the right things to get them to write for your particular right. publication series.
Right. Now, at this stage in your career, what are you looking forward to?
Well, I think things are going to change starting next February quite a bit, taking over as right. the president. So this is going to be a big change for me. I tend to be a research mathematician, and when I have a chance, boom, go off to the corner and think mm-hmm. about things, and you know, maybe maybe spend 5 hours there. Uh-huh. And then realize, oh, wait a minute, I was supposed to be at a meeting. I don't think I'll be able to do that for the next 3 years. So that's going to be a pretty big change. But I look forward to it. Mm-hmm. Just visiting all these, as I've heard from the past presidents, how many trips I've got to take to mm-hmm. NBA regional meetings. This is going to be interesting. Mm-hmm.
Are you looking at all beyond that?
Well, I'm hoping I survive.
You have a wish list?
I hope I survive.
Do you have sort of a wish list of things
after
that you would like to do?
Well, is
that
sort of,
after the presidency.
You know, I haven't.
I mean, that's
really,
sort of kind of interruption now.
Yeah, it really is. And, I mean, that's a good question. I'm spending so much time thinking about what I have mm-hmm. to do as president right. that, you know, my wife's, she's going to retire when mm-hmm. I finish the presidency. That's when she finishes her job. Mm-hmm. And so we're already planning a trip. That's about a 1 month trip when I finish. That's about as far as I've gotten into post MEA presidency.
But there's no sort of envisioned book or a compilation or special project?
Well, lots of things come up all the time. You know, I've years ago I wrote 2 introductory books on chaos and, well, dynamical systems, and they're getting quite old now. And I've always thought of I'm not just updating them but changing them. You know, because my focus now, when I'm teaching, either at the graduate course in dynamics or the undergraduate course in dynamics, it's always mm-hmm. focused on research. You know, I don't mm-hmm. give them any problems. Mm-hmm. I'd rather I hand the students a pet function. Mm-hmm. Each student gets their own pet function. During the course, I work mostly with my pet, which is x squared plus c. Mm-hmm. And I go to z squared plus c. Mm-hmm. So I do the dynamics of quadratic mm-hmm. functions. They have sines, exponentials, cubic functions, whatever. Mm-hmm. And their job is to figure out something that's A, interesting, mm-hmm. and B, they can do, and then their job is to present it, you know, mm-hmm. to light something up. They give presentations in class and stuff like that. So my thought has always been to write a book based on those ideas, sort of, you know, research experiences in dynamics. So just do the simplest mm-hmm. case. Oh, yeah, talk about a few of the other mm-hmm. cases, but leave... You know, each student would be positioned to take each topic, whether it's bifurcations or periodic points or mm-hmm. chaos or whatever, and mm-hmm. interpret it mm-hmm. in terms of their functions. It really, I found over the years, makes a difference, you know, especially for our graduate students. They come in, they're worried, oh, I've got to make a 25-minute presentation mm-hmm. on something I'm not really sure of, and they're scared at first. But by their third presentation at the end of the semester, when it's an hour-long presentation, they're the world's expert on tangent mm-hmm. of x cubed, and they know it, and their presentation shows it. So it makes mm-hmm. a difference in terms of having students go out and find their own problems to work on, which mm-hmm. usually is on the last page of each chapter, mm-hmm. and then secondly, be able to communicate it mm-hmm. in the right way. And that really harkens back to one of the pivotal moments I had as an undergraduate. Yeah, actually, where is really where it comes from. In my senior year, I had this particular fellowship that basically freed me up from taking any course. I had to sit in on courses and mm-hmm. take them, but I didn't have to, you know, take the exams and all this mm-hmm. stuff. But rather, I had to get involved in a research project. Mm-hmm. And I was the first mathematics student to ever have that at my particular institution, mm-hmm. as I understand it. And so the faculty, you know, I didn't know that they were going to be able to help me or whatever, so I went to the one faculty member, and he said, okay, yeah, sure, no problem, here, read this, there must be something there. Well, I read this paper, 2 days, went back, okay, I read it, what do I do? Mm-hmm. He said, read this, there must be something there. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, there's something there, I read it. Okay, went back the third time, and he said the exact same, read that, it's got to be something there. He was telling me I had to come up with my own problem, which that never happened to me before mm-hmm. back then. So that was a really interesting experience. And then, of course, when I went off to do my thesis work with Smale, essentially he didn't say the same thing, but essentially did the same thing. Read this, there must be something there. No problem, I'll go figure it out. It makes a difference when you, have to come up with your own problems that are interesting and doable, and then you can do them. That's what mathematics is all about, or research mathematics anyway.
That's covered my list of things to ask about.
All right, good.
Did I miss something?
No.
Well, I could ask about hobbies and interests outside of mathematics.
Right, you can see them. Very sunburned, these all sailing that I've been
doing.
Ah,
all right.
It's going to be 100 degrees this weekend up in New England, and I'm going to sail again.
Down here and all kinds of places.
Yeah, well, no, it's 100 degrees down there. It's 95 and off the Cape this summer, this weekend. So, but I have to remember to put sunscreen on this time.
Right. But, good. Okay. I think that will work very well.